The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're going to try to keep it simple for you today, just two main subjects that I want to get into. For the second segment, we'll look back on the Steele dossier. I guess it's not that old, but 2 years ago today is when CNN ran that story about the meeting that Jim Comey had with President-elect Trump. And then soon after CNN printed its story, then BuzzFeed went and printed the entirety of that dossier, all 34, 35 pages of it. And so we'll look at some of the contents from that dirty dossier and also see just how much it's been used to attack the United States, to attack that incoming administration in the case of what was happening 2 years ago at this time. And, of course, it's still going on, as we well know. Well, the media in the United States, they like to talk about bombshells all the time, particularly with respect to Donald Trump. This bombshell is going to bring him down over and again. You could create a nonstop montage with them referring to these so-called bombshells. And of course, through it all, they what they end up doing is they miss the actual bombshell when it comes along. Yesterday on the program, I talked about the rise of populism and nationalism in Europe and how that's actually going to bring a stronger Europe together, a smaller European Union, but a stronger one, more powerful, more unified, more together than ever before. Well, today in the Times, there's a headline, a couple of them. The first one here, Merkel and Macron's answer to populism, an ever closer union. And so here is Germany and France, and they're looking around Europe, and they're saying that the solution to all of this, well, you could say iron and clay, is an ever closer union. Now, these are the strongest members of the European Union by far. And so even though you have these populist movements in some of the smaller nations, it's Germany and France that we want to keep our eyes on. These two, this axis, these two powerful nations, they're calling for an ever closer union. And that closeness, it starts with this relationship, Germany and France. The other headline at the Times, it says, Paris and Berlin herald new era of integration. The article says, France and Germany are to forge shared defense, foreign and economic policies in an unprecedented twinning pact, regarded as a prototype for the future of the European Union. As I say, this is a real bombshell. You look at the events of just the past 2 weeks, and we've talked about a lot of these things on this program, and now we have articles coming out in the Trumpet, the latest Trumpet. Look at the cover feature in the February issue. My father's had all sorts of programs in the U.S., three of them, on France, Germany, and of course, France is split with the United States. But you look at all that's happening going back to the armistice from the early part of November. Emmanuel Macron calling for a real European army. And then he went and praised this Nazi collaborator from World War II. And then through that same time, he's publicly rebuking Donald Trump, the president of the United States. He says that President Trump is not a patriot. And around this same time, France's finance minister calls for a European empire. That's the word he used. And he urged Germany to take the lead. It wasn't long after that when Angela Merkel, she said, yes, we need a real, true European army. And then what about Emmanuel Macron's visit to Berlin, where in front of the German parliament, he says, France loves Germany. I'll come back to that a little bit more in just a moment. France loves Germany. But here is this Times piece from today. Paris and Berlin herald a new era of integration. It says Angela Merkel and President Macron will sign a treaty this month to open the way for the neighbors to present a united diplomatic front and act jointly in peacekeeping missions. In other words, they intend to unify their military strength, their military might. It says both countries will lobby for Germany to receive a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council alongside France, the U.S., China, Russia, and Britain, the victorious allies at the end of the Second World War. All of these victorious allies, they want to bring Germany in as one of the top strongest nations in the world. They want Germany to have equal say, equal power. How soon we forget that history, that dreadful history. Germany's no longer seen as a threat, not at all. To even think that's so 20th century. It says France and Germany also intend to speak with one voice in Brussels, drawing up common positions before pivotal European Union summits, in an effort to make the bloc a more decisive power on the world stage. And so here are these two, the strongest two, and they're going to come to a common position before pivotal European Union summits. They're going to go in. This sounds great, doesn't it? If you're in Germany or you're in France. But what about all the other member states? What about the smaller states? What about the weaker states? What about the ones that are in debt? Or the ones that have a population size that's just a fraction of what it is in Germany or France? The Times says the treaty is designed to signal that France and Germany will uphold the values of multilateralism at a time when the global liberal order is under threat. It says both President Macron and Mrs. Merkel have expressed frustration at the rise of populism and nationalism and at Europe's dithering in the face of problems, such as climate change and mass migration. They're frustrated. They see the liberal world order. It's unraveling. And so they want to come together. A new era of integration. Now, we know in the end, it's going to be a mixture of iron and clay. There's going to be plenty of iron strength, but some clay mixed in. It's going to be headed up by a strong man. That's Daniel 8. Surrounded by the 10 kings. That's Revelation 17 and verse 12. And the two strongest among them are going to be Germany and France. Listen to this. This is the Times. The brief document, this treaty, will be signed on January 22nd. Just a couple weeks from now. Less than that. It's going to be signed on January 22nd in Aachen, Germany. And the Times says here, the location is heavy with symbolism. Aachen was the Frankish imperial capital under Charlemagne and has passed back and forth between Germany and France several times. Could they make this any more obvious? Look at this world today as this bombshell report comes out. It'll receive a little bit of coverage today, and then that's it. It's off the news cycle. The signing in 12 days in Aachen, Germany. That's where Charlemagne's capital was situated. You look at how fast these events, as I say, are moving. Mr. Armstrong, in one of his old radio broadcasts, he stressed just how fast moving these events are happening behind the scenes. And then when they come out into the open, The world's just going to be startled. Here's what he said, clip 7.
Gradually and now faster and faster, a new power is being developed from underneath the surface, a new world power, which the public now least suspects, which the world does not yet see, doesn't realize, doesn't dream is coming, but it is developing just as prophesied in Europe, a resurrected Roman Empire that will combine some 350 millions of population, a power so mighty that our Western peoples will stand aghast when it flashes suddenly into full being. Yes, your Bible says that the world will be startled.
The world will be startled. It will stand aghast. Our peoples are going to stand aghast when they see this happen. It's forming right now. If you're listening to this show or you're reading the Trumpet magazine, you know, you see it coming. And they're no longer talking about it. We need this. We should do this. It's happening. The Times says, the text bears, this is that treaty, the text bears the imprint of Mr. Macron's desire to use Franco-German consensus to rally the EU into becoming more assertive as a global power. They use the word rally. There's no rally about it, though. This is a Franco-German consensus that's going to impose its will on the other 8 members. It says further, it lays the groundwork for a Franco-German defense and security council that would act as a political steering group. Further on, it writes, Berlin and Paris will also frequently exchange diplomats and civil servants. Ministers from one country will regularly sit in on the other's cabinet meetings. This is integration. This is union. This is empire. It says, on the military front, the treaty enshrines an ambition to form a common culture and common deployments overseas. So there's the military. France, remember, has nukes. They want more integration in light of what's happening to the Western liberal order. They want more integration to deal with problems like mass migration and other problems. It says here, this final quote, listen to this. Diplomats from some other EU member states view the Aachen Treaty with suspicion. Let me just read that again. So here are other member states. Diplomats from some other EU member states view the Aachen Treaty with suspicion. There are concerns that the ever closer union between the bloc's two most powerful economies could create a juggernaut capable of crushing dissent beneath its wheels. Can you begin to see how that this gets pared down to the 10? It's going to be pared down in a hurry. The other 8, you see, there's prophesied to be 10. It's prophesied to have 10. So here's 2. The other 8 are going to have to submit to this German-Franco axis. That's what it amounts to. And then you can see how some others would say, well, thanks, but no thanks. I think I'm going to follow the way of Britain. I think we want to plan our exit strategy. Now, all of this coincides with that featured article, as I said. It's in the February Trumpet, and it's hitting mailboxes right now. My father's featured piece, France rejects America and empowers Germany. They've rejected America. They're reaching out to Germany. That's in the latest Trumpet, and that material springs from those 3 programs that my father recorded back in November. Isn't it amazing when you receive the latest Trumpet magazine, and even though the articles are prepared a month or 5-6 weeks in advance, it's incredible to see just how topical it is, just how right up to date it is with what's happening in the news. Let me take you back to this program. I think this one aired in December, December 7th, so it was probably recorded near the end of November. This is my father on his Key of David program, clip 1.
France loves Germany. Now, what kind of a statement is that? He never has said anything like that to his 2 brothers, and they are sons of Israel. And there are other ones, but there's a lot of focus on especially Joseph in this end time. So here he's saying that he loves, that France loves Germany. And France was taken out of captivity to Germany in World War I and World War II by Britain and America. And he's just turning his back on them, as he was prophesied to do in this end time.
That's from my father's December 7th program. He's talking about a Macron statement there in front of the German parliament. We love you. We love Germany. He won't say that about his brothers. The brothers are Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. When he talks about Ephraim and Manasseh, when France talks about his brothers, it's an open rebuke, a betrayal. And at the same time, we see France, this nation that went into captivity in two world wars in the last century. And now France is coming into a closer, more integrated union with Germany, my father went on to say in that same show, clip two.
But I think that's a most pathetic statement. And I think it's almost like saying, well, they just don't have the will to ever stand up against Germany again. So they're just going to join in with them. And France will betray his brother Joseph, which is Britain and America.
It's just a surrender. That's what it amounts to. That's what this treaty really is. Now, again, my father brings this out in the article. Mr. Macron, they all have a lust for power. And right now you look at German leadership and there is weakness there, but that's about to change. And so I'm sure all of these leaders, even when they come together in this 50-50 union, think that they'll be the one to take the lead. Someone will. It's like Mr. Armstrong used to say about a marriage. You can say it's 50-50, but someone's going to take the lead. In this case, it's Germany. One final quote from that Key of David, clip three.
I think President Macron is just groveling before Germany and saying, well, we'll be your servant. We'll do whatever we have to do just to be a part of your great power. They just don't seem to have the will to fight like Winston Churchill did in World War II.
They won't fight or stand up to Germany. They reserve that for the United States or for Britain. My father, again, that material, it's quoted or put together in the February issue of the Trumpet. France rejects America and empowers Germany. He talks about how that France is going to such great lengths to support Germany, to help Germany, groveling even before Germany. Germany is Europe's master. Germany will be France's master. So here is all of this material from those November programs. It's put out there weeks, months before this treaty. And now they're about to sign it on January 22nd in Aachen, Germany, the capital or the headquarters for Charlemagne. And you know all about the spirit of Charlemagne, which so many European leaders, they want to see it resurrected. My father said in that article, France really does love Germany. You can see it in these important joint ventures. That was written before we ever received news about this treaty. But here is yet another joint venture. We're going to come closer together. It says further on, well, in this piece, he's quoting, my father's quoting from James Pinkerton, this article that we read on this program a few weeks ago, who in this piece he's talking about how the would-be Charlemagnes would build an empire in Europe. It says, Pinkerton went on to write that he believes Macron wants to be Charlemagne. I agree. Macron recognizes that Germany lacks strong leadership right now. He knows Europe needs a strong man. So, like my father said in one of those earlier shows, I don't have the clip here, but he fancies himself as that strong man. And so he goes groveling before Germany, thinking that in the end it will help him maybe politically. And maybe that's why he's this eager to sign this treaty with Germany now. He sees a weak leader in Germany. Miss Merkel is much weaker now than she was years ago. But my father says in that same article, the Bible tells us that this coming strong leader will not be French. The strong man will command the army Macron is helping to build right now, my father said, but it will be a German that takes it to war. Well, if you haven't gotten around to that article yet, it's in the February issue of the Trumpet magazine, and it really does, together with what we went through just here today, it really does show how fast these events, these prophetic events, are moving in Europe. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll look at some of the history from 2 years ago, and even before that, leading up to the publication of the infamous Steele dossier. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States. One in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror. Their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe. And it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Christopher Steele is the ex-spy, used to work for MI6, and he was a man on a mission. He hated Donald Trump. He wanted to prevent Donald Trump from winning the election in 2016. And then, to carry on from there, they didn't get their wish, of course. He wanted to destroy his presidency after the fact. And so he puts together all these memos, 17 of them, I think, over the course of about 6 months in 2016. The first one was in on June 20th, 2016, and it runs through to the end of December, making all of these crazy and ridiculous charges based on nothing, no credible sources. In some case, he'd just get a phone call out of the blue. It's just a total fiction. The Russian regime has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting Donald Trump for at least 5 years, he said in June of 2016. So that goes back to 2011. Donald Trump is a Russian stooge. He's a puppet of Vladimir Putin's. That's how all of this got started. With these memos, there was a bit about the Russian prostitutes in that first memo from June. The presidential suite in the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow. And how that they defiled the bed upon which the Obamas once slept. Just crazy. And then they had video evidence. The KGB equivalent. It had video evidence of all of these disgusting acts. And they were holding it against Donald Trump. Blackmailing him. That's what it says in these memos. Orgies in St. Petersburg, Russia. And then bribes that Donald Trump made to make these stories disappear. There was the bit about Michael Cohen, who supposedly met with a Kremlin official in Prague. And you remember those sound bites I played for you a few weeks ago. That Washington Post reporter saying that they were turning up every stone in Prague to try to verify these charges, to try to prove that he was with the prostitutes or that Michael Cohen was in Prague, and they couldn't do it. Carter Page is mentioned over and again in the dossier, and that's significant because he was a low-level player. And that's the one that they got the warrant to wiretap so that they could spy on the Trump campaign, so that they could spy on Donald Trump. Carter Page supposedly made a visit to Russia. Well, he did make a visit, several. I think there's like 200,000 Americans every year that visit Russia, so that's not exactly a news flash. But now, not in the Obama years, certainly not with respect to the Clinton family, they can travel to and from Moscow as much as they want. They can have contacts with Russian agents. They can have contact with Russian diplomats. But no one in the Trump campaign, no way. You so much as visit. You touch down in a plane in Moscow and you are a spy. It's confirmed. According to the dossier, Carter Page, again, a relative nobody in the Trump campaign, he was supposedly promised by Russian officials that if then-candidate Trump would promise to lift the sanctions on Russia, that Donald Trump would get something like a 19% stake in this massive Russian oil company. This is in the Steele dossier. Russia agreeing to give a candidate. He didn't even win the election yet. But according to the memo, there was already a deal in place. I guess a multi-billion dollar deal. Just absolute crazy, fictitious, scurrilous, scandalous allegations. And some of it, like I read to you a few weeks ago, coming in from unsolicited phone calls. I think I read somewhere where the last time Steele even visited Russia himself, he got it, remember, supposedly he got it from Russian sources. The last time he's been in Russia, it's been more than 20, 25 years. And remember, he was, as he admitted to the Justice Department in 2016, he was desperate. He was desperate to prevent Donald Trump from winning the election. So no red flags here for the media, for the DOJ, for John Brennan. John Brennan was the one that was really pushing it out there. He wanted the media outlets to run with this story. And then later it was Clapper and it was Comey. And then they set up the president-elect, with that January 6th meeting in 2016. And then, as we now know, CNN, BuzzFeed, they ran with the story on this day 2 years ago. You think about what my father writes in America Under Attack. how that Satan's goal, his big goal, is to bring down Israel, whether you look at it spiritually or physically. And given what we witnessed, so many of us, what we went through in spiritual Israel, in God's church, there really are a lot of similar parallels to what we experienced in the late 80s, early 1990s. Satan, Jesus said in John 8, is the father of lies. What does it tell you about never-ending investigations and spying and informants and all of that? What does it tell you when you look into these memos, this dossier, and see that it's just all a pack of lies? It's been said that this is opposition research. This is normal for a campaign. But this is not even research. This is not opposition research. These are outlandish lies. This is satanic propaganda. That's what it was from the beginning. And yet look at what it unleashed. Look at what it triggered. Wiretapping, informants, spying, illegal unmasking, investigations. Remember that comment that Greg Miller, that was the Washington Post reporter, he said there, in essence, he said, we really don't have any evidence to prove these allegations. And it's not for a lack of trying. We have tried and tried and tried to find the evidence. They want so bad for this to be true. They will send reporters to Prague to search every hotel, the records at every hotel in Prague. They hate Donald Trump that much. So Greg Miller admits it's not true. The details aren't true, but overall, in its broadest, most accurate, or the sweeping conclusions that it makes, those are pretty much accurate. It's just all the details of the specific charges that we can't prove. In other words, it's fake, yes, it's fake, but it's accurate. Others haven't even held that position. Michael Isikoff, he's the one, I think the first one to refer to the dossier, although he didn't get into some of the details like CNN did and BuzzFeed, obviously. But he's admitted since that it's likely false. I think Bob Woodward, these are left-wingers. Bob Woodward says it's a garbage document. It's been thoroughly discredited. And yet, this garbage document, to use the words Bob Woodward used, this is what Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe and Rod Rosenstein and Sally Yates, this is what they used to convince a FISA court to give them a warrant so they could spy on the Trump campaign. They knew going in, as Comey himself said later, they knew it was salacious, they knew it was unverified, and yet they used it to deceive FISA court judges. Greg Jarrett, in his book, The Russia Hoax, he makes a fascinating point about FISA courts, and most Americans don't really know anything about it because it's all done in secret. It's not out in the open. But he says in his book that 99% of all FISA applications are approved. 99%! That's because if they're DOJ or FBI officials coming into the court saying, look, Your Honor, we need... this is dangerous. There's some real crimes happening here. 99% of the time, the judges are going to say, well, okay, there's no two sides about it. There's not another side that says, well, no, they shouldn't get this warrant. This is our evidence of why it would be unjust, unconstitutional. It's just one side. And these are government agencies. And as Greg Jarrett says in his book, the FISA court operates in secret. It's not an adversarial venue. No opposing views are presented because no other side is present. The integrity of the process is entirely dependent on the government being truthful and forthright. And so these documents that we now know, and even still, they're heavily redacted, but we now know that they relied upon the dossier. Were it not for the dossier, they wouldn't have gotten the warrants. And so you look at the documents that were filed in court, and they carefully concealed the dossier. Its origins, I mean, the fact that it was funded by the Hillary campaign, the fact that it was political or opposition research, they concealed all of that. They didn't tell the judge that because they knew it was unverified. They knew it was salacious. They knew it was a political hit job. But they got some reporters like Isikoff to comment on it. And they went in and said, Your Honor, yeah, there's these reports put together by a British spy. And then it's also been in the news. It has been in the news. The circular reporting. And that's what they use. I think it was Andy McCabe who said, there's no way we would have gotten those warrants were it not for the infamous Dirty Steel dossier. Listen to Rod Rosenstein. This is from last year, early in the year, where he talked about just the seriousness of the FISA court applications, clip 4.
There's a lot of talk about FISA applications, and many people that I see talking about it seem not to recognize what a FISA application. A FISA application is actually a warrant, just like a search warrant. In order to get a FISA search warrant, you need an affidavit signed by a career federal law enforcement officer who swears that the information in the affidavit is true and correct to the best of his knowledge and belief. And that's the way we operate. And if it's wrong, sometimes it is, if you find out there's anything incorrect in there, that person is going to face consequences.
Well, nothing's happened as yet. Who's faced consequences? I think there were 4 applications over and again. It's not that they just did it once. Every 3 months, they had to renew it. So 4 times, and with signatures, these applications carrying the signatures of all the Obama people, all the names you're well familiar with. He's talking about, well, Greg Jarrett says, the integrity of the process is entirely dependent on the government being truthful and forthright. That's right. And then Rosenstein said there, look, these are career law enforcement officers that go in and swear that the information is true. And if they get it wrong, they're going to face consequences. No one has. A couple people here and there lost their job, and that's it. That's it. Certainly no charges are ever brought. So it's bad enough that this document, this dossier, it's used to illegally spy on an American, many Americans. But then you come up to that critical period in January of 2016. Just to refresh your memory, President Obama, he's the outgoing president. This is 2 weeks before he leaves office. He meets with all of his intel chiefs. You've got James Comey, Mike Rogers, John Brennan, and James Clapper. And I think Vice President Biden was in the meeting as well, 6 of them. So you got all these intel chiefs, the FBI, NSA, CIA, and then the National Intelligence Director. It says at the New Yorker, the main purpose of the Oval Office meeting was to run through a startling report the U.S. intelligence chiefs were about to release to the public. The highly classified report included a 2-page appendix about the dossier. So they were having they had this intense research going on at the time. Before the election, remember President Obama, I've played the clip before, he said there's no way that the Russians could meddle in our election or tamper with our process. It's too decentralized. It couldn't happen. And then as soon as Donald Trump won, they all changed their tune. They all said it was because the Russians. It wasn't just that the Russians meddled. They meddled so much it helped Donald Trump. That's how he won. And so Barack Obama, he orders this the intel community to gather all of this material, to put together a report to show how the Russians interfered. So they're meeting together on January the 5th, all these intel chiefs. And then it was Jim Comey's responsibility to then go to the president-elect the next day, that would be January the 6th, and to brief him on this report and that two-page appendix that was about the dossier, the contents of the dossier, a summarization of the dossier. Here's how Jim Comey remembered that crucial two- or three-day period there, clip five.
President Obama asked, what's the plan for briefing that material? We had decided that Director Comey would meet with the president-elect privately after we briefed the president-elect and his team on the general findings so that he could review it in a more private, more sensitive setting with the president-elect.
That was James Clapper. How did President Obama respond to that?
He didn't say a word. President Obama has a great poker face, but he simply turned. So if I'm President Obama, he turned slightly to his left, looked at me, and went like this, and then looked back at Director Clapper. So kind of gave me a Groucho Marx is how I thought about it, double eyebrow raise, didn't say a word, but communicated to me at least, and I could be misreading it because I don't know President Obama's eyebrow raises, that sort of a sympathy and concern, like good luck with that.
So good luck with that briefing. You're going to have to brief the president-elect on all of this material. So before I get to that meeting, this same day, January the 5th, when Obama's meeting with all of his intel chiefs, after that meeting, there was another meeting, again, with Vice President Biden, and this time with FBI Director James Comey, and then the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, and then President Obama's National Security Advisor was in there as well, Susan Rice. Now, Sally Yates, at the time, she was the acting Attorney General. She was working in place of Loretta Lynch, who was no longer around at that time. So no one else had been confirmed by the Senate to replace her. And here is Sally Yates, an Obama holdover. So you have Obama meeting with the heads of the FBI and the DOJ. Yates would be fired something like 10 days later because she wouldn't enforce President Trump's travel ban. And just as an aside, when she did that, Andrew Weissman texted her or emailed her saying, I'm so proud. I'm so proud of you for defying the president. This is the same Andrew Weissman that is now Bob Mueller's right-hand man. So she's around for a few days further. Jim Comey, of course, was fired in May of 2017. But here's this meeting. After the intel meeting, here is President Obama meeting with the chief investigators. And as we now know, President Trump was being investigated. He was a target in this counterintelligence investigation. And here is the outgoing president meeting with the head of the DOJ. Meeting with the FBI director. Now, about that meeting, that January 5th meeting, I should say, the second meeting, it was Susan Rice who was in there. She's the one who later emailed herself on the day of the inauguration, January the 20th. She emailed herself and said, well, what got most of the publicity about that email was the fact that she said Obama stressed that everything should be done by the book. Everything should be done just by the book. Andrew McCarthy, regarding that, he said, we might counter that people who've lived by the book for 8 years would not have to remind each other to go by the book. It would go without saying. But why would President Obama be talking to the investigators when all the previous year he said it to Chris Wallace in April of 2016, and then he said it in his final press conference in December of 2016. He never meddled in investigations, ongoing investigations. Listen to what he says here, clip 6.
One thing that I have done is to be pretty scrupulous about not wading into investigation decisions or prosecution decisions or decisions not to prosecute. I have tried to be really strict in my own behavior about preserving the independence of law enforcement, free from my own judgments and political assessments in some cases. And I don't know why I would stop now.
So he said there that he doesn't wade into investigation decisions or prosecution decisions or a decision not to prosecute, which is exactly what he was doing. First, with respect to Hillary Clinton, in the Chris Wallace interview, he said, "Look, I don't interfere in an investigation." And then in the same interview, he said she's not guilty of any crime; she was just careless. And then a month or two after that, James Comey comes out in that FBI briefing where he exonerates Hillary Clinton and uses pretty much the same language that President Obama used on national television 2 months earlier. So he lets Hillary off the hook. He directs it. It goes all the way to the top. And then we get to the end of 2016, and there's this spying going on. There's this counterintelligence investigation going on. And there is President Obama with Sally Yates, with Jim Comey. And because it looks so suspicious, you have Susan Rice emailing herself saying, "Oh, about this suspicious meeting, he was just telling us to go right by the book, that's all." Notice what else she said in that email. That email she sent to her own government account, which was about to be closed that same day. She said, "President Obama said he wants to be sure that as we engage with the incoming team, we are mindful to ascertain if there is any reason that we cannot share information fully as it relates to Russia." So that's President Obama talking to the chief law enforcement officials 2 weeks before he leaves office, advising them on what they could withhold from the incoming president. Andy McCarthy said, "It's easy to understand why Obama officials needed to discuss withholding information from Trump. They knew that the Trump campaign, not just some individuals tangentially connected to the campaign, they knew the Trump campaign was the subject of an ongoing FBI counterintelligence probe." So it makes sense. Obama's giving them some coaching on the way out, saying, "Now be careful. There's some things you can't bring up with this incoming president. He's being investigated. So you've got to be careful." Well, then comes, let me just read one more quote from McCarthy. It says, "Clearly, the Obama officials did not want Trump to know the full scope of their investigation of his campaign, but just as important, they wanted the investigation, an insurance policy," that's the way Peter Strzok put it, "an insurance policy that promised to hamstring Trump's presidency to continue." So, how to accomplish these objectives? Plainly, the plan called for Comey to put the new president at ease by telling him he was not a suspect. So he was a suspect. He was a target. We now know that. It's obvious. But he went into that meeting, Comey did, to say, "You're not a suspect. You've got to set him at ease." It's the same strategy they used with Mike Flynn. "Hey, there's nothing to worry about here. We just want a nice, friendly little chat." So Comey goes into this meeting. This is January the 6th now, 2016. And he sets the president at ease. And he says, we've got this intel report. Russia did interfere. And, oh, by the way, let me just tell you about this two-page appendix. It's about this salacious, unverified material that some in the media are just itching to report on, but they need a news hook. This is how Jim Comey wrote about it, or I guess he discussed this with his staff. He emailed his staff the day after his meeting with President-elect Trump. And he said, I said there was something that he's talking about these meetings. I said there was something that Clapper wanted me to speak to the president-elect about alone or in a very small group. This is what Comey wrote. I then executed the session exactly as I had planned. And I said media, like CNN, had them, the memos, the dossier, and they were looking for news hooks. In fact, the news hook was that it was brought to the president-elect's attention. Once he was briefed on the dossier, then CNN had the hook that it needed to run with the story. Because even the media outlets to that point, they knew it was ridiculous. They knew there was no sourcing. But now it had been brought up in a presidential briefing. This makes it news. So on January the 8th, then FBI Deputy Director, this is Andrew McCabe, he sends out an email to senior FBI leadership under the subject line, a flood is coming. Oh, yes, you can see him. You can imagine him rubbing his hands together. The setup worked. They've got the hook. McCabe said CNN is close to going forward with the sensitive story. The trigger for them is they know the material, that's the material from the dossier, was discussed in the brief and presented in an attachment. That's the trigger. That's the hook. And here comes the flood. He was excited. He was excited about this. Look at how close. Look at the collusion between the FBI, DOJ, and the media. He knows CNN's about to run with it. How did he know this? Well, CNN did run with it on this day 2 years ago, January the 10th, under the headline, Intel Chiefs Presented Trump with Claims of Russian Efforts to Compromise Him. He could be blackmailed. Well, as soon as CNN talked about it, then BuzzFeed, they printed this dossier, this despicable document, in its entirety. And then James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, he comes out and he sends out an official statement in response to these leaks and acknowledges. He says, I called President-elect Trump. I expressed my profound dismay at the leaks. This is extremely corrosive, he said. This is damaging to our national security. That's what he said publicly, following those reports on January the 10th. And we now know that it was Clapper himself who called CNN to make the leaks. It was Clapper who was stabbing the president-elect in the back, even as he came forward with this statement. The House Intel Committee report from last year, it says, when initially asked about leaks related to the dossier in July 2017, former DNI Clapper flatly denied discussing the dossier or any other intelligence related to Russia hacking of the 2016 election with journalists. It says, Clapper subsequently acknowledged discussing the dossier with CNN journalist Jake Tapper and admitted that he might have spoken with other journalists about the same topic. But back then, 2 years ago, after he sprung the leaks, he sends out this official statement. He says, we also discussed, he's talking about his private phone call with President Trump or President-elect. We also discussed the private security company document, which was widely circulated in recent months among the media, members of Congress, and congressional staff. He's talking about the dossier and the IC, the intelligence community, how it became aware of it. He said, I emphasized that this document is not a U.S. intelligence community product and that I do not believe the leaks came from within the IC. It's a total lie right there. It says the IC has not made any judgment that the information in this document is reliable, and we did not rely upon it in any way for our conclusions. In fact, they relied upon it to get the warrant to spy on the campaign. In fact, they used it. They used a meeting with President-elect Trump as the hook to get it out into the open so that it could slander the president, the incoming president. A total setup from the very beginning. A total setup. January the 10th, just 2 years ago, you still see the lingering effects, the lingering impact of this dirty dossier. Read more. Read more about the real being behind all of this in my father's booklet, America Under Attack. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.